It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
You're listening to Deconstructive Criticism. My name is Aaron Flam, and today we're talking to Professor Charles Grobe. Dr. Grobe has been the director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA Medical Center since 1993. And even for a specialist on mood and anxiety disorders, he's extraordinarily sympathetic and calming. Professor Grobe is a believer in the self-medication hypothesis of substance abuse, which basically means that he thinks that if someone is using or abusing a substance, it might be because of a biological or psychological lack that the subject tries to compensate for. His research has included the first FDA-approved phase one study of the physiological and psychological effects of MDMA, a multinational collaborative study of the Amazonian plant hallucinogen decoction ayahuasca in Brazil, and a pilot investigation of the safety and efficacy of psilocybin, that's magic mushrooms, in the treatment of anxiety in adult patients with advanced stage terminal cancer. And on top of everything else, he's an expert on hallucinogenic literature and the author of the book Hallucinogens, A Reader, which provides a good overview on the topic in case this discussion prompts you to find out more. Now, please enjoy.
So how did you come in contact with hallucinogens to begin with?
Well, growing up in the 1960s, you couldn't avoid the issue. It was there. And I went off to college in 1968. I went to Oberlin College in Ohio, which was a very progressive school. And I promised my mother I would not experiment with drugs. That was a concern of hers. That was when I left for school. But by the time I came back my freshman year, I had had ample experience and ample opportunity to experiment with my peers. And I was just fascinated. And so my freshman year in college was when I first had an experience with a hallucinogen. I however, quickly realized that taking a drug like LSD in a dormitory room was not the optimal environment for taking these kinds of compounds. So after a couple of years, I ceased my personal use, but remained fascinated with the topic and continued to read every opportunity I had. And ultimately, it helped to determine my career path. When I was in my early 20s, I had dropped out of college, and actually my father was very concerned about what he perceived as my lack of direction, and told me that when I decided what to do with my life, he wanted me to call him. He didn't care what time of the day or night it was. He wanted me to call him. So I had this job at that time as a research assistant on a dream research study at the Maimonides Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. And my job was to stay up all night, monitor EEGs, identify when there was a dream, wait for the end of the dream, and then wake the the dreamer or the sleeper who was in a sensory deprivation chamber wake him or her up on an intercom and then ask them to report their dream, and I recorded the dream. But to stay up all night, I needed engaging material to read, and one of the doctors there had collected just about every article written up to that point in the professional literature on psychedelics, and I just devoured all this material. And one night I had this epiphany. I knew what I wanted to do. It was 3 a.m, but my father had told me to call him regardless of the day or of the time of day or night. So I called him, woke him from a deep sleep. And once he sufficiently woke, I told him I had decided what to do, that I thought psychedelics were fascinating. I wanted to investigate them. And there was so much to learn about the brain, the mind-brain interface. There was so much to learn about mental illness. And there were these extraordinary models that one could utilize to treat people who were not responding to conventional treatments. And he thought for a moment or two, and then he said, "Well, son, there may be something to what you say, but no one will listen to you unless you get your credentials." So at that point, I knew I had to go back to school and get my credentials. And my path was to do pre-medical studies and then go to medical school and then ultimately train in psychiatry. Of course, by the time I got out of medical school, it was impossible to conduct any approved research with psychedelics because they had become so taboo. And but I just kept, going through my training and becoming a physician, first training in medicine and then in psychiatry and then in child psychiatry, but continued to read as much as I could. Every month, I remember in medical school, I had this ritual. I went to the medical library at the beginning of the month when the new issue of Index Medicus arrived, which this is before the age of the internet. So you wanted to know what was out there and published in the world of medicine and science. You go to Index Medicus, and I would look up terms such as lysergic acid diethylamide or mescaline or hallucinogen, and there was generally nothing of great interest because research around the world had been repressed and stopped and put on ice.
Yeah.
So, but I just kept, I found a lot of gratification in being a physician, helping people. I liked the work I did, but maintained my interest, stayed in academia, and first at Johns Hopkins, then at the University of California, Irvine, and then at UCLA and at Harbor UCLA. Then in the early 90s, I had my opportunity to first conduct this research.
I see. So you not only broke your promise to your mother, you made it into a career to break that promise.
Yes, you could say that. You could say that. She did not have a great comfort level with what I was doing, but she was a loving mother and a good mother and always supported me. My father, though, he had some interest in this area. And I'll tell you a story. He, in the early 70s, shortly after I told him what I wanted to do with my life, and at which point I was planning to go back to school, I went to Columbia to do my pre-med studies, I told my father I was going to attend the lecture of a Mexican psychiatrist who was visiting New York. His name was Salvador Roquette, and he had a very unique system of administering psychedelics. So I took my father to the talk, and afterwards we went up to speak with Dr. Roquette, and my father told Dr. Roquette that, "Oh, it just so happens next month I'll be in Mexico City at the medical school giving a lecture." So Dr. Roquette said, "Oh, here's my card. Come and visit me." So my father said, "Sure, I'll visit." And I thought, oh, he's never going to visit, especially because he's traveling with my mother. Mm-hmm. She would never allow this. But as it turned out, they visited Dr. Roquette at his clinic. He showed them around, explained to him his treatment model, and said, "You know, just so happens tonight we're doing a group session. Why don't the two of you join us?" And my mother right away said, "Oh, I couldn't do that. I have 4 children, meaning she had too many responsibilities to lose her mind and not be able to retrieve it. My father, though, without missing a beat, said, "Okay, what time?" My mother was furious with it. So Dr. Roquette said, "Well, if you come, don't eat anything the rest of the day." My mother was furious with my father. And he said, "I won't go." And to prove the point, they went out and had a big meal, after which he said, "I think I am going to go." So in spite of her protestations, he went to Dr. Riquette's clinic, and he, along with 20 of Dr. Riquette's Mexican patients, was administered mushrooms. My father said he had to peel the cow dung off of the mushrooms, so these were quite fresh and from the natural state. And Dr. Riquette's model was one of sensory overload. He was really aiming to shatter your psychological defenses to have kind of the primal experience. So there was very intense music, and he had projected on three different walls in the room, three different films, silent. But on one wall, there were beautiful aesthetic scenes from beautiful natural pictures and the beauties of nature. On another wall was documentary footage of warfare, death, destruction, bodies in the street. And on the third wall, there was projected pictures of erotomania of any variety you could imagine. And the other patients were emoting very loudly and moaning and wailing and screaming. And my father started to feel sicker and sicker. And so he dragged himself to the bathroom, where he retched his guts out, collapsed on the floor, thought he was dying. One of Dr. Riquette's assistants saw that he was missing from his area, so went to find him, found him in the bathroom, dragged him back to his spot on the wall, where my father tells me later he then had a vision of a powerful vision of a people dressed in very primitive desert clothing, walking in a desert, one behind the other, connected from one to the other by their umbilicus. And he realized these were his ancestors. And it was this very profound vision that provided, I think, great insight to him, a connectedness to his own personal and ancestral past. He never again took a psychedelic, but he loved to tell me the story, which I, of course, asked repeatedly over the years for him to retell. And he would kind of, reflect back on this remarkable experience and unique experience that allowed him a glimpse into another realm, into a transcendent realm that I think really changed him fundamentally as a person. Prior to that, he was very, intense, hard-driven, type A personality, just driven to succeed. And after that, he really did mellow quite a bit, had, I think, more of a heart-opening experience and was more connected to those around him. He kept his same job. He was a professor of medicine and a chief of medicine, and he was extremely effective at what he did. But there were some fundamental changes in his personality. And I think it also allowed him to better understand what I wanted to do. And it allowed him to be really, I think, quite supportive. As long as I had my credentials and did this work the proper way through the system. And for me, that's what I've done.
Yes, you certainly have. You're also the author of this little book, Hallucinogens a Reader.
Yes.
And I haven't read it, I must admit, but I have read most of the things you quote in that.
Okay.
I am also a nerd, you see.
Okay. fellow travelers.
Yes. Yesterday you mentioned, and this is the reason why I was so nervous about interviewing you, because I don't know where to start. Should I talk about your experiments, or should I talk about your extensive knowledge in hallucinogenic readings, texts? Because yesterday you mentioned something that I don't always hear. You mentioned the Tassili Plains of Algeria, 7 to 9,000 years ago.
Right.
What happened there?
Well, we know what was occurring there so many thousands of years ago because of archaeological finds, specifically cave paintings depicting a shamanic practitioner. And in the cave painting, there were mushrooms attached to his limbs, down his torso. The shaman also wore a mask in the shape of a beehive, a cone-shaped mask, and the significance of the bee cone was that honey was a preservative, and to preserve the mushrooms, one would put them in honey. But these mushrooms depicted on this painting along the shaman's body were, they're unmistakably mushrooms, and other evidence has pointed to the fact that around the world over millennia there were mushroom cults, or the indigenous people would utilize psychotropic plants that grew in the area as part of their spiritual belief system, as part of their healing system. And there's no denying that these plants were of extraordinary value to early man, and really helped contribute to forming the bedrock of what became human civilization, even though their use was eventually repressed by the advent of, the modern state. And But there's been we've kind of recovered much of this knowledge in over the last half century.
Yeah, because do you believe in the stoned ape theory of evolution? By the way,
the stoned the Terence McKenna theory.
Yes,
that the apes started to ingest psychoactive mushrooms and felt compelled to somehow or other articulate the visions they saw. I mean, it's a compelling theory. I don't know.
And it does connect well to the story of the apple in the Garden of Eden.
Doesn't it?
I mean, Gordon Wasson talks extensively about this.
Right. That the, ingesting from the tree of knowledge, breaking some deep taboo and cast the Adam and Eve out into the wilderness.
Yes.
Yeah.
So on the plains of Africa, at least we have one piece of proof that there has been mushroom cults in human history.
Right.
And you said in your lecture last night also that psilocybin mushrooms...
Specifically, containing the alkaloid psilocybin.
I believe you said there is at least 186 known species,
probably more by this time.
Yeah?
Yes, containing psilocybin.
And they seem to move with human colonization.
That's right. They seem to follow areas where humans inhabit. They are also associated with the domestication of cattle. They are coprophilic. They grow on cow dung. They seem to be attracted to the nutrients provided in such a medium. And the proof is irrefutable that these mushrooms exist, and they've been utilized throughout, I think, human history. Why would they not be? They were growing in a particular area, people, particularly indigenous peoples, would tend to test out the local plant material. They would determine which plants might have nutritional value, which plants were toxic and to be avoided. And then these remarkable plants, which seem to induce visionary experience, why would they not look into the range of effects and harness their power for their own tribal needs?
So these cults and rituals were spread out throughout heathendom all over the world.
Oh, I believe so. I believe so. You know, in some areas of the world, there is a richer colonization of psychotropic plants, particularly in Central and South America. Other areas less so, but there's evidence of psychotropic plants throughout the world, and no doubt the indigenous people of those regions knew exactly what the range of effects were and learned how to harness their power.
Yeah, well, we are currently in a country where, you know, we have both Sámi people up north,
and
they are known for having used at least Amanita muscaria.
That's right.
And the Vikings love the Psilocybe similantiata. We call it toppslättsskivling.
Uh-huh.
And they used to put it in liquor
and let it be there.
And then when you take a shot, it really mellows you out.
Yeah, the German writer Christian Rach talks about archaeological finds of the beers that the pagan peoples of the Germanic states before the Roman conquest and the Christianization, that these alcoholic beverages also contained evidence of hallucinogenic mushrooms.
Yes. In older times, people didn't really care about mixing drugs.
No.
Or they actually cared, but they wanted to mix drugs.
Right.
And then with the coming of Christianity, I suppose, the repression of hallucinogens started.
Well, the coming of Christianity was a death knell for the the pagan religions and the use of psychoactive plants, either the old rituals used by the pagan peoples or moving into the Middle Ages and beyond, the repression of the use of hallucinogenic plants by Europeans, particularly by midwives, and the horrible persecution of midwives who use psychoactive plants as part of their healing.
Were termed witches, I suppose.
They were identified as witches, and because of their behaviors, they were deemed heretics, and they were often treated very punitively with the harshest punishments of the Inquisition, including torture and death. It was quite brutal, and in parts of Europe, enormous percentages of the female population were actually put to death. There was a shortage of women at various times in the 1500s, 1600s. And their association with these psychotropic plants were deemed as proof of their heresy.
Because ingesting these plants were considered to be in liaison with the devil.
And they were diabolical, absolutely. And so it's not only in the New World that the Europeans, particularly the Spaniards, identified use of psychotropic plants as heresy. It was also happening in the Old World, in Europe.
Yes.
That's a piece of history that's often forgotten. There was a writer from the 19th century named Michelet, Jules Michelet, who wrote, I think, extensively about the treatment of the of women in general and midwifery in particular, and how they were repressed and often brutally murdered because of their activities. It was a terribly misogynist time where the church was at the forefront, and I would also say with the collusion of the male physician class, who may have resented the competition that the midwives represented.
Yeah, no, and that in this country it's been obvious. If you look back a few, like 100 years, to when we introduced we now have a state monopoly pharmacy, or now we don't again, but we used to for almost 100 years have a state monopoly. And when you look at how the medical profession tried to force out all these little wise women and wise men in each village, because
that's right,
they could usually make either the hallucinogens or the amphetamines.
Right.
Yes.
Right. And they were competition.
Yeah, they were.
You know, the physician class wanted to dominate the market.
Yeah,
and they've done a good job of it.
They have indeed. And then you moved in, and you mentioned briefly yesterday the Florentine Codex. Could you just please explain to my listeners what that is? It is, Bernardino de Sahagún.
Right. Yeah. So the year 1616, the laws of the Inquisition were deemed applicable to the New World. And it was declared that any native persons, or really anyone, including Spanish settlers, who dared to utilize the rich hallucinogenic plants that were available and in wide use in native ritual, that anyone who dared to use these would be punished by the rules of the Inquisition, and including execution. Horrible torture followed by execution. So it was a way to repress native culture. It was also a way to assure that the native Spaniards would not stray from their Christian faith and engage native belief systems, because this was deemed, quite taboo and heretical and threatening to the authorities.
Of course it was. I mean, if the priest is the only channel to God, and there's a mushroom growing outside the church,
In early Christianity, there was a demarcation where it was deemed direct access to the spiritual realm was no longer accessible. Instead, the fact that there might be a spiritual realm would be accepted on faith, and faith alone, not by direct experience.
Well, there might be a shortage of shrooms, you know, you can't share with everyone.
Fortunately, you can cultivate that. So.
Nowadays, you can. Yeah. In the old days, people didn't know.
They thought they were given birth
by thunder.
Because they weren't like the flowers. That's right. Yes. That's right. But, you know, it's harder to eradicate plants than it is to eradicate people or groups of people.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Yes. So you've also devoted a lot of your life to actual STEM research.
Yes.
And your first famous experiment, I think, was on MDMA.
Right. In the early 1990s, we submitted a protocol to the FDA asking for permission to treat a patient population with terminal cancer, with overwhelming anxiety and depression, with an MDMA treatment model. They responded that it was premature to work with a patient population. That there had yet to be a phase one study with normal volunteers. Of course, there had been no phase one study with normal volunteers because none had been allowed, in part because of the allegations that MDMA was a neurotoxic substance. We were quite skeptical that there was MDMA neurotoxicity. We felt that the evidence was quite flawed. The research designs were flawed to yield a particular result. There was questionable interpretation of data. Conclusions we felt were erroneous. So we challenged the whole neurotoxicity premise. But the FDA said, we're not going to allow you to treat a patient population, but if you come back to us with a new protocol looking at a normal volunteer, and we didn't think it was going to be possible to look at normal volunteers because of the neurotoxicity concerns, but I think we're also quite unimpressed with the neurotoxicity data. They encouraged us to come back with a new protocol. We did. We got approval to run it was the first study, above board sanctioned study, allowed to evaluate the range of effects, both psychological and physiological, of MDMA in normal adult human volunteers.
And how did that go?
Fine. Our individuals tolerated the experience quite well. I'd say with the exception of two of my subjects had hypertensive reactions. One, this was an illustrative point. It was a young man who was in for his third treatment session. I knew he had had two other experiences with MDMA that he had tolerated just fine. On the third occasion, he had a hypertensive episode. In about an hour, his blood pressure went from 120 over 80 to about 200 over 110, which had me quite concerned. So I said to him, you know, something has got to be different. So he explained that we started the treatments early in the morning, and the subject, to get to the hospital early, he stayed at a friend's house who was near the hospital. His friend had a cat. My subject was allergic to cats. So the friend of the subject said, and the subject started to have breathing problems that morning because of the cat. So his friend said, why don't you try some of my asthma medication to help with your breathing? Well, it helped, but the subject came in and didn't feel it was important to tell us that he had been on a new medication, that because we had asked him earlier and he had said no medication. So it was a drug interaction. So that's I think an important kind of safety issue that people need to understand, that drug interactions may be problematic and they need to be very careful and scrupulous about you know other medications that they may be taking. And the other subject was our oldest subject. You know, I used to call him my elderly subject, but now since I'm actually older now than he was then, I've changed him to my late middle age subject.
All right.
So he just had labile blood pressure, and it just shot up, you know, rather, you know, somewhat unexpectedly. But we managed to treat it effectively. Neither subject experienced any lasting harm, but it did, you know, make me somewhat anxious, and was a telling point that one has to monitor these experiences very carefully, and there are potential medical risks, particularly for a drug like MDMA.
But there is no neurotoxicity.
No neurotoxicity. We feel that was entirely overblown and the result of very flawed research in the service of a political agenda fostered by
liars.
by liars and by vested interests within within the federal health and research authorities. Yeah. One thing these neurotoxicity investigators received was lavish funding from the National Institute of Drug Abuse, which had an agenda to demonstrate that that MDMA was a neurotoxic substance. I once approached the former head of NIDA to ask, why wouldn't you consider examining an MDMA treatment model, particularly for patients who didn't respond well to conventional treatments? And he responded by saying that they were not in the business of supporting research that would identify good things about bad drugs. So these were bad drugs, so they were taboo and not to be allowed. But I must also mention that the regulatory agencies and the people at the FDA were very open and receptive and reasonable and willing to grant us permission to do human research. And ultimately, the whole neurotoxicity perspective was thoroughly debunked. And in many respects, the neurotoxicity researchers shot themselves in the foot. In the early 2000s, they published a paper in Science, one of the world's most prestigious journals, that not only does MDMA in the monkey model they were using induce serotonergic neurotoxicity, it also causes dopaminergic neurotoxicity, the implication of which is that all of these young MDMA users are going to induce Parkinson's disease, which involves dopamine degeneration. And there was a headlines across the world that MDMA causes Parkinson's. Well, not too long after, it became evident that these monkeys were not actually injected with MDMA. Instead, they had been injected with methamphetamine from bottles that had been labeled MDMA. And you'd expect methamphetamine to cause dopamine damage.
Yeah.
So then how did that happen? Well, the investigators blame the company that made the research grade drug, and the chemical company says no, they have too many safety features and quality control features in place for this to have ever occurred. And the answer has never been determined as to who was responsible, but at the end of the day, it really did cause people to take.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Take another look at the whole MDMA neurotoxicity position and realize that it was not what it had been built up to be, and that while MDMA may have some inherent medical risk, particularly for vulnerable people, it was not a causative agent of neurotoxicity, not by a long shot. And in fact, in recent years, there's been some very, very good human research with using an MDMA treatment model for people with chronic post-traumatic stress disorder and getting excellent results, far superior than conventional treatment models using SSRI antidepressants.
So you weren't satisfied with the results of this study, which is getting a lot of neurotoxicity biologists to shoot themselves in the foot.
Right.
And then you moved on to ayahuasca. But
right, yeah.
But before we go into that, I'd like to ask you, so this MDMA treatment was used for post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yes.
Was it used primarily on military personnel or?
Well, this was Michael Mithoffer from South Carolina. His study. They initially worked with a number of policemen, firemen, victims of assault, women who had been raped. Subsequently, he's had some opportunity to work with veterans and has even engaged the Veterans Administration in the possibility of working within the VA system to help to do at least conduct some research looking at vets who had been traumatized by their war experiences.
And as it stands now, if you look at the research and the evidence out in the world, does it look as if, though, MDMA is going to be included in treatments against post-traumatic stress disorder?
Certainly they're establishing the case for more wider-scale research studies. I mean, we're not at the point yet where sufficient numbers of people have been studied, but we're coming to that point. An organization called MAPS, which has funded the MDMA, most of the MDMA work, has... It really is on the threshold of starting what is called a phase three study, which would be multi-site, many sites around the country working off of the same protocol, and then in so doing, you know, develop, you know, examine and document the treatment response to several hundred subjects. So it's a matter of developing numbers of people who are going to be treated before it can be established as an acceptable treatment.
I understand. And then you moved into ayahuasca.
Right, right.
And how did that come about?
How did my ayahuasca research come about? Well, really through my friend Dennis McKenna, who...
I met him this summer.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. Dennis is quite a character.
Yes, he is.
a very good friend and a very long-term friend who in the 1980s, along with his brother Terrence, had gone down to the Amazon basin in South America, had a significant degree of ayahuasca experience. And Dennis is a kind of a hardcore scientist, and he became really motivated to explore the effects of ayahuasca in humans. So he spoke with me about putting together a protocol. He had some connections in Brazil to a Brazilian ayahuasca religion called the UDV, the Unidade Vegetal. Dennis needed a psychiatrist and someone with academic credentials, and I told him, I'm definitely your man. So together we created a protocol that we took to Manaus in the north of Brazil, in the Amazon, and we conducted a fairly extensive psychiatric medical evaluation of long-term members of the UDV who participated at least twice monthly in group rituals using where ayahuasca was used as a psychoactive sacrament. We had a matched number of non-ayahuasca exposed controls, and we worked both groups up along a number of different parameters, medically and psychologically, neuropsych testing, looking at memory and cognition, personality testing, psychiatric diagnostic testing. And with the ayahuasca group alone, I did life story interviews, really ascertaining. I asked them basically three questions. I said, how did you first come to experience ayahuasca? What was your first ayahuasca experience like? And how has it impacted your life since? And we also had it for each of the ayahuasca religion members. We had we studied them under the acute effects of ayahuasca. So we had in the context of their religious temples, we created a little mini medical clinic where we had people with indwelling intravenous catheters, electrocardiograms. They were administered the ayahuasca by a maestri or a religious leader saying the religious incantation. They would sit in a chair and we would draw blood every 20 minutes and check blood pressures every 30 minutes and had EKGs going and looked at pupillary diameter and other parameters and
destroying people's trips in general.
Oh, it was. They I have to hand it to our subjects. They were heroic to endure what we put them through. Thanks. But yeah, the UDV they had strong belief in science. And in fact, they date the genesis of their church to a mythological founder who was actually King Solomon, who in their mythology came from from the Middle East to the New World to collect the highest grade timber to use in the construction of the temple in Jerusalem. And when in the rainforest, Solomon discovered that these two plants, which when taken by themselves, are entirely not biologically active, but when brewed together into a decoction, induce powerful visionary states, which they identify as ayahuasca. So the UDV believed in science. They also needed, they were under some political attack, and they what was be important for them to have a scientific demonstration of the safety of their psychoactive sacrament. So they were very gracious hosts and allowed us to do all sorts of things, including installing intravenous catheters and drawing bloods, with frequency during ayahuasca experience.
Well, if I remember my Old Testament correctly, the wood that was taken to construct the first temple, at least, was taken from the cedars of Lebanon. And I think I do remember my Old Testament correctly because I had a very strict upbringing.
But
it is interesting to note because this UDV church probably, if we disregard their mythological founding, can just as easily had been founded by the conquistadors' attempt of psychoactive repression, right? Because it seems like if you start to convert a lot of indigenous people, and they did that by force, I suppose, and they still have their old culture, and this looks like a melding together.
It was syncretic. These were syncretic religions where they would take elements of Christianity, take elements of other folk religion, and as well as the indigenous traditions, and they would meld together. But what they also had, the native peoples had to do, was keep secret their use of hallucinogenic plants. So in many respects, they camouflaged what they were doing, and it went deeply underground. In some areas, it was expunged altogether, but in other areas, it simply went underground and was kept away from the prying eyes of the Spanish and Portuguese invaders.
Yeah, and your study helped, I suppose. You demonstrated.
We demonstrated within the context of the UDV that these individuals were healthy. They were not ingesting a toxic substance. They were in good medical health. They were in very vigorous psychological health. In fact, they had gone. Many of them had, and we documented this, had gone through very impressive transformations, positive transformations. Some of these individuals prior to their entry into the UDV Ayahuasca Church, were very dysfunctional. They were alcoholics, drug addicts. Some had had brushes with the law, had served time in prison. They were abusive to their wives. They were not good fathers, irresponsible and reckless in their behavior towards their parents. But after their entry into the UDV and their regular bi-monthly consumption of ayahuasca within ceremonial context, they transformed. They became highly responsible. Their value system, evolved to a very high point. They became very good spouses. They became very responsible parents, very respectful children to their own parents. They became far more successful in the working place. Some became, some of the leaders and pillars of the local communities. So they were outstanding examples of how when these compounds are taken under optimal conditions, they can facilitate life-changing positive transformation.
And optimal conditions in this case is both the drug and the context. So the context is hugely important. There's a moral doctrine in the UDV church, I presume.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. So I'll tell you a story. So absolutely. And this is, and again, this is not for pleasure, for hedonic purpose, for recreational purpose. This is very serious work. So the structure of the sessions are initially individuals are given a cup of the liquid ayahuasca. They hold on to it till everyone has a cup, and then the religious leader says a religious incantation, and everyone drinks in unison, and then they sit down. Initially, for about 45 minutes to an hour, there's music played, and everyone is in silence, sitting. And then the for the next hour and a half to 2 hours, there are songs individually sung first by the maestries, and then individuals in the congregation will raise their hand, ask for permission to sing one of their religious. These are religious songs, which are usually about the founders, the mythological founders of the church, or odes to the beauties of nature, and then after maybe 3 hours has elapsed, when individuals are kind of coming back down somewhat, where they can be more receptive to the spoken word and to a sermon, the maestri gets up and will talk about values, the importance of leading a moral life, the importance of being good to your family, good to people you work with. So we were invited to attend these ceremonies, and of course it would have been very rude to have turned them down. And of course we were very curious and very eager to participate as well. And I my Portuguese was limited, and I had a friend who was fluent in Portuguese who acted as my interpreter. And at one point, towards the end of a session, there was an active dialogue going between the maestri and different members of the congregation. It was all in Portuguese. I couldn't follow what was being talked about, but I thought, to really understand, I really want to know what they're talking about so I could better understand how this church functions and how they facilitate changes in their congregation. And my interpreter had lapsed off into silence, so I leaned over to her and I asked her to tell me, what are they talking about? So she said, well, Charlie, what they're talking about is how important it is that if you say you're going to be someplace at a certain time, you be there. And I thought, this is amazing. This is the basis, in part, for their success. Be responsible. If you say you're going to do...
Especially showing up on time in Brazil must be unheard of.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it... to me, it kind of explains some, you know, how... Look, when people are under the influence of a hallucinogen, they're in a hyper-suggestible state.
Yeah.
So if they hear a message about being a better person, living to higher values and higher principles, you know, really incorporating a true morality... And being good to your neighbor, they instill that within their very being, into their core, and they become better people. You know, the flip side is if in some other context, like a some weird
Viking cult in Sweden 6,000 years ago,
or a Charles Manson cult in the late 1960s in California, where the cult leader says, do horrible things because these are horrible people and you're in a hyper-suggestible state, then boy, all bets are off. You better watch out. This could get very scary very quickly. But in the context of the UDV, they're receiving a very pro-social message to be better people. And they take it in and they become better people.
Yeah. It's how often do they do these rituals?
Well, the first and third Saturday evenings of every month, along with special religious holidays.
That's quite a lot of ayahuasca, too.
That's a lot of ayahuasca. Yeah. And again, our subject in the study, to be in the study, you had to be a member of the UDV for at least 10 years. So they consumed a lot of ayahuasca over that time, and they were very high-functioning individuals, some of whom had stories from earlier in life of being pretty low-functioning and not good people. And they like I said, they had transformed into the... As Abraham Lincoln would have said, the better angels of their nature.
Yes, and Obama as well, I think.
Yes, yes.
Because it is interesting, because you don't think that these types of drugs help everyone, right?
No, they're not for everyone.
No.
Absolutely, absolutely. But some people who are called to this experience, it can be of great value. Other people really need to be screened out.
Yeah, and you... pretty much know if you're called, don't you?
I think so.
Yes.
I think so. And peer pressure is not the way to go about this. So peer pressure is to be avoided. I think an individual knows within their core if this is their cup of tea, as
yes.
it were.
Ayahuasca tea. Because yesterday at the lecture, you said that this can be potentially the hallucinogens, a treatment against alcoholism and drugs.
Yeah.
Psychosomatic disorder, that is hypochondria of different
right.
varieties,
right,
I suppose.
Right.
Chronic post-traumatic stress, we dealt with that with the MDA, OCD, which I obviously suffer from because I can't stand this. Antisocial behavior, works against that. Autism, which surprised me.
Yes, well, I mean, the autism research was, you know, it was with younger people. It was using diagnostic criteria, which were different than we use today. So they would refer to many of their subjects as autistic. I've looked through some of the old records, and I questioned some of their diagnoses. But they did find in some of their patients remarkable positive change. I knew this psychologist in California named Gary Fisher, who did a fair amount of work at Fairview State Hospital in Orange County, where he treated – he had a ward of exceedingly disturbed, institutionalized young people – and he had, you know, permission to work with psilocybin and would administer treatments. Some of these young people did not respond, but some had, you know, remarkable responses. He described one teenage girl who was, you know, very, you know, hardly talked at all, was very, very self-destructive, had to wear a helmet because she was a chronic headbanger, had, you know, terrible social skills, was, you know, very dangerous to herself, sometimes had to be put in restraints to stop her from hurting herself. He started to have regular psilocybin sessions with her. I think he treated her over the course of maybe a couple of years, 20 times. And then he received a notice from the government basically telling him to cease and desist, that he had to stop all of his treatments and turn over his supply of the drug he was using. So he went to tell her of that they would no longer be able to have such experience, that they'd no longer be able to have this these opportunities, these experiences, these treatment sessions. And she took in, and during this time, she became had become far more functional. She was able to engage in intelligent discourse. She was no longer self-destructive, no longer needed to wear a helmet, no longer headbang, no longer was put in restraints. Her social skills started to improve noticeably, and she was becoming a healthier person. But when she was told that they had to stop the treatment, she kind of was silent for a while, and then she said to Gary, she says, "But Gary, how will I see God?" And it was very, Gary said, you know, whenever he thinks about it, he almost tears up, how sad that was, how poignant.
Yeah.
You know, but let me, all this being said, I think today our approach would be not to administer these compounds to children under, you know, under any circumstances, and be very circumspect about administering them to adolescents, particularly maybe the older adolescents, but under approved, highly controlled context. So this is not, I wouldn't want to urge people to administer these drugs to children, but back in the early 60s, Gary Fisher had the opportunity to make some interesting observations. And he found in some, not all, but in some of his patients, pretty dramatic improvements, whereas previously no treatment had any effect whatsoever.
That is both, it makes me glad to hear that it works and sad to hear that you're not allowed to make it work.
Right.
Yes.
Right.
And then the last thing you said that psilocybin could be a treatment against, which is also referring to your latest experiments, is existential anxiety in terminal cancer.
Right, right, right. So we, you know, some of the early research from the 60s, which I found the most compelling, were Stan Groff's work at Spring Grove, Maryland, through the University of Maryland, administering LSD and in some occasions intramuscular DPT with terminal cancer patients with overwhelming anxiety, depression, demoralization. He had very, very profound results. You know, I saw him.
And just a short, DPT is?
Dipropyl tryptamine.
Yes.
So it's related to dimethyltryptamine, DMT, but it's only active when injected. And it's never used, you know, today, but I think it was an option that they utilized when individuals could no longer swallow pills because of their, if they had oral, you know, cancers or cancers of the throat. But Groff did some remarkable work, and I heard him speak 1972. It was very, I was very impressed. I was very moved, his publications were some of the most moving scientific articles I've ever read. So in the early 2000s, with the encouragement of my colleagues on the Hefter Research Institute, I developed a protocol designed to look at advanced stage cancer patients with reactive severe existential anxiety. And we were allowed to proceed with a pilot investigation using a moderate dose level of laboratory synthesized psilocybin, 0.2 milligram per kilogram. And we found really positive results. First of all, no one had any adverse reactions. The only adverse reactions in the course of the study were during placebo sessions, because we had chosen niacin as a placebo. I wouldn't use that again as a placebo.
What happens on niacin?
Oh, people have some people don't have any reaction or just a mild tingling. That was purpose to induce a mild physiological effect, so they may think they're under the influence. But sensitive people can have a severe flushing reaction and start itching very badly. And we had a couple of poor niacin responses. But insofar as people who received the psilocybin, everybody tolerated it very well. And
because the end of life is not a pleasant experience for most people.
The end of life is a very frightening prospect for most people, and it's filled often with fear and anxiety, depression, demoralization, isolation, and mainstream medicine and psychiatry often has very little to offer. Although in recent years the hospice movement has been quite effective, still for many people it's a time of terrible dread and terrible psycho-spiritual suffering. We had very good results that we were approved to treat a limited number of people, only 12 people. We still found statistically significant points where we could demonstrate significant drops in anxiety during a 6-month follow-up period and improvements of mood over a 6-month follow-up period. And I stayed very close with these people, for most of them for the remainder of their lives. And I could see that their overall quality of life improved. Their relationships with family were improving. They're able to heal old rifts. They were able to get out a bit more, be more social. I had one woman who had given up going to the to concerts. She loved classical music. She could no longer go because she felt she was too demoralized, too depressed to go. She renewed her subscription to the symphony and took great pleasure in going to these events. The quality of life noticeably improved.
Because that was what you said yesterday. It's not about how you can't do anything about the end of life, but you can do something about the quality of the animal
life.
That's right.
I mean, the purpose of the treatment is not to impact the cancer per se. We're not trying to cure cancer. That's not at all what's going on here. What we're trying to do is address the psychological reaction to knowing you have a terminal disease and you have limited life expectancy. And I think we were quite... I was very encouraged by our results, and we have colleagues on the East Coast at NYU and Johns Hopkins who, subsequent to our study, were able to get permission to use a higher dose, and they had more funding, they treated more people, and they got excellent results. They just published in 2016. So I think this field is definitely moving forward. There's clearly a potential for utilizing it in this context, also with other treatment groups, patient populations for whom, and I think this is the beauty of this treatment, that it might be helpful in patient populations for whom conventional treatments are not effective. Another example is alcoholics, chronic alcoholics, notoriously one of the most difficult and devastating conditions for medicine to treat. Medicine does a very poor job. We haven't really progressed much more than our colleagues from 50 years ago, who, if an alcoholic came to them for help, they refer them to a 12-step group. And for some with whom that was a good fit, that might work. But a lot of others, that didn't really do it. We don't have good treatments. But going back to the late 50s with Humphrey Osmond in Canada, he demonstrated that the chronic hardcore alcoholics – could be effectively treated with even one session of a psychedelic administration, one monitored session.
How large a dose?
He was using, I think, a good, you know, a fairly impressive dose. But be as it may, it was only one experience, but it had such an impact on at least some of these alcoholics that they were able to establish and maintain sobriety for the period of Osmond's follow-up. And this was replicated by Groff's work. Curiously, both Osmond and Groff found that those who had the greatest likelihood of achieving and maintaining sobriety over the long haul were those who, during the course of their many-hour one session, had a powerful psycho-spiritual epiphany, a mystical-level experience. That seemed to be predictive of positive treatment outcome.
Well, it would calm me if I was dying to know that God actually exists.
Right. Oh, yes. Exactly. And Groff also found this, and his colleague Walter Pankey also found this with their terminal cancer patients, that the best treatment outcomes were with those who had that mystical level experience during the course of that one session, or in some cases, two treatment sessions.
Yes, and I should note to the listener also that if you're listening, I'm not meaning that God actually exists. I'm talking about an experience of oneness with the universe.
Right, and an awareness, let's say, that there is a transcendent realm that under normal circumstances we are generally cut off from.
Yes.
It's quite an astonishing revelation to some people, and seems to have an intrinsic therapeutic impact.
Yesterday at the lecture, you told me a story I hadn't heard before, actually, which is, surprises me, about the death of Aldous Huxley.
Oh, sure.
On the 22nd of November, right?
November 22nd, 1963, the same day that John Kennedy was assassinated, Huxley passed away. And Huxley, in the last 10 years of his life, was fascinated with psychedelics. He only took them a handful of times, but was so profoundly impacted that most of his writing over the last decade was on the potential value of psychedelics in society. I mean, look at his novel, Island, a much not sufficiently appreciated as one of his greater works. It really lays out his whole understanding of psychedelics and their potentials and also what the risks were. But Huxley, as I said last night, he not only talked the talk, he walked the walk. And when he was dying of throat cancer, arranged with his doctor and his wife, Laura, to have administered 100 micrograms of LSD. And, Laura, who I got to know quite well, described, I mean, he couldn't talk at that point, but he was quite at peace. But curiously, what a coincidence. On the same day John Kennedy is assassinated, irrevocably changing the course of not only U.S. history, but really world history, that same day, Huxley, the great visionary, also passed on.
Yes. Under the influence of 100 micrograms of LSD.
LSD. Yes. That's right.
Seems like a very nice way to go.
Well, we never got his trip report, but to hear Laura's description, he was quite at peace.
I hope so. If the doors of perception were cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is, infinite and in all its glory.
William Blake, and he took that as his title for his great book, describing his very first experience with mescaline administered by Humphrey Osmond in 1953, The Doors of Perception.
Yes, which also led to the naming of the rock group The Doors, I presume.
Yes, that's right.
Yes.
That's
so correct. There is a clear line one can see through the literature of hallucinogens.
That's right. That's right.
Thank you so much for talking with me.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you for listening. Links to Charles's books and studies can be found in the description of this episode on Patreon, where you can also donate some money if you feel like it. I am Aaron Flam. Until next, have a good time, unit.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.